On the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
U.S. health officials have identified the next Americans who should receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Among the groups are people 75 years and older, as well as essential workers such as firefighters, teachers, and food store employees. The guidance was issued Sunday by a group of medical experts who lead the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The committee is part of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Leaders of the group take a vote to decide. The nation's first COVID-19 vaccination effort began 1 week ago, when the first doses were sent to vaccination centers throughout the country. The CDC committee decided earlier this month that the first shots should be given to healthcare workers and people living in care centers. That group is estimated to include about 24 million people. The CDC said that as of Sunday, about 556,000 Americans had been given vaccine shots. The first COVID-19 vaccine approved by the Food and Drug Administration was developed by American drug maker Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech. A second vaccine developed by Moderna and the U.S. National Institutes of Health was approved last week and began shipping on Sunday. The groups the CDC committee identified as next in line for the vaccine make up an estimated 50 million people. Those considered essential workers include firefighters and police, teachers, and other school employees. It also includes individuals working in food, agriculture, and manufacturing industries, as well as post office and public transport workers. The groups are considered at very high risk of infection because their jobs are critical and require them to be in contact with other people. Officials say it is not clear how long it will take to vaccinate those groups. Vaccine doses have been produced slower than earlier estimates. Some experts also note that some people in the groups may choose not to get vaccinated. The CDC committee has also voted on the next groups it thinks should be vaccinated. Among them are people aged 65 to 74 and those aged 16 to 64 at higher risk because they have medical conditions like obesity and cancer. The expert committee's recommendations will be used by U.S. states as they create their own vaccination programs. Federal officials have said they expect vaccine doses to be limited for several months. CDC officials say up to 20 million people are predicted to start getting shots this month, another 30 million next month, and 50 million in February. That would be 100 million out of a population of more than 330 million. Public health experts say the shots, and others still being developed, are the only way to stop a virus that has been spreading uncontrollably. Nationwide, more than 219,000 people per day on average test positive for the virus. COVID-19 has killed over 317,000 people in the United States and nearly 1.7 million worldwide. I'm Brian Lynn.
People in the United States and Europe welcomed the arrival of the Western-made coronavirus vaccine. However, the Russian-made vaccine has not been as popular in Russia. There are reports of empty medical centers that offer the vaccine to healthcare workers and teachers. These groups are the first members of the public permitted to receive it. Russian officials and state-controlled media said the Sputnik V vaccine was a major development. It was approved on August 11th. But among Russians, there is concern about the vaccine. Some fear it was hurried to the public while it was still being tested for effectiveness and safety. Russia faced international criticism for approving a vaccine for tens of thousands of people that had not completed all its testing. Experts both in Russia and worldwide warned against its use until the tests are completed. Russian officials started offering the vaccine to some high-risk groups, such as medical workers, within weeks of its approval. Alexander Ginsberg is the head of the Gamaleya Institute, which developed the vaccine. He said recently that over 150,000 Russians have been vaccinated with it. One person who received the shot was Dr. Alexander Zatsepin. He is a critical care specialist in Voronezh, a city 500 kilometers south of Moscow. He received it in October. "We've been working with COVID-19 patients since March, and every day when we come home, we worry about infecting our family members. So when some kind of opportunity to protect them and myself appeared, I thought it should be used," he said. He also said he still makes efforts to protect against infection because studies of the vaccine's effectiveness are not over. "There is no absolute confidence yet," he said. After Britain announced December 2nd that it had approved a vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech, President Vladimir Putin told officials to start a large inoculation campaign. Many believe this was a sign of the government's desire to be at the front of the race against the pandemic. Russia approved its vaccine after it was tested on only about 20 people, saying it was the first in the world to receive approval. Drug makers named it Sputnik V. Sputnik was the name given to the world's first man-made satellite launched by the former Soviet Union in 1957. Russia has had more than 2.7 million cases of COVID-19 and over 49,000 deaths. The country also wants to avoid another damaging lockdown of its economy. On December 2nd, Putin announced a target of over 2 million shots in the days ahead. However, Russia's population is 146 million. Shots are free to everyone in schools or in health centers, social and city workers, service workers, and artists. The European Medicines Agency said it has not received a request from the vaccine makers to license it for use in the European Union. The Russians did, however, share information about their vaccine with the United Nations World Health Organization. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Before the pandemic, self-care, caring for ourselves, may have not been a priority for many people. But now, 9 months into a worldwide pandemic, taking care of our physical and mental health is even more important than usual. There is no exact way to practice self-care. It includes many areas and may look different from person to person. For some people, self-care may be simply slowing down. It can also mean controlling parts of your life that you can control. This is important when the world around you feels out of control. Slowing down has worked for Tanya Speaks. She is a 43-year-old fashion expert from Fort Mills, South Carolina. Before the pandemic, she was often running to and from business meetings, and she did not make time for exercise. Now, the mother of two exercises regularly. She says she is happier with a slower, less busy life. She adds that she also feels more in control. Taking care of myself, Speaks said, is one way for me to have control. The World Health Organization defines self-care as the ability of individuals, families, and communities to be and stay healthy. This includes preventing disease and dealing with sickness, with or without the support of a healthcare provider. The WHO also defines self-care as eating well, being active, and living in a safe environment. Self-care includes both individual wellness and the wellness of the greater community. In the best cases, the WHO says that self-care methods can strengthen national institutions and improve a community's overall health. Thinking of it this way, self-care could also involve checking on your neighbors, talking more with friends and family over the phone or in video calls can be a form of self-care too. These things strengthen our community and improve our own mental health. For some people, self-care might include doing things they have always wanted to do but never made time for. These things include baking, gardening, and learning a new language or some other new skill. Another form of self-care is making time to meet with a mental health specialist, if needed. The Associated Press reports that online mental health services have increased during the pandemic. However, meeting with a mental health professional may not be possible for some people. So a doctor with the American Psychological Association has suggestions for other ways to reduce stress during the pandemic. Dr. Vale Wright says meditating, writing about your feelings and problems, and organizing the physical space around you are all forms of self-care. She adds that connecting with others right now is also very important. Experts remind us that self-care during the pandemic could feel like riding a roller coaster, up some days, down on others. Some days you have a great day when you did all the things you wanted to do, Dr. Wright said. Then the next day, she added, you might sleep late and eat unhealthy meals. It can also help to have a routine, a usual way of doing things. But experts say keep the routine simple. They also say it is important to not be hard on yourself if you do not keep to your routine every day. Remember, they say, be kind to yourself. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury. And this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. He asked that his name not be put before the convention. He met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth President of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, "We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system."
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick." When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, "I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now."
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. "When I came to power," Harrison said, "I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election."
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.